Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie. And on this evening's The Space Show, Nothing So Hidden, Episode 2 of 3, The Voyage of Apollo 16. Now, if you are one of those people who keep a list of all the astronauts that have been in space, well, as of an hour ago, pretty much exactly an hour ago, you have got two more names to add to your list of people who have never been in space before but are now in space. Yes, at about just around about 10 to 6 this evening, a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket launched the Crew Dragon spacecraft into orbit to catch up to the International Space Station, which they will do sometime tomorrow. And there are four people on board. Two have been in space before, and two are newbies. And of note, at the launch site to watch that launch was an astronaut who's walked on the moon, a geologist no less. And a newbie on the spacecraft was a geologist as well, so there's a connection there. Yes, Harrison Smith was there at the Kennedy Space Center to watch the launch of the rocket. Well, time now to go to episode 2 of our Nothing So Hidden. Welcome to part 2 of our 3-part series, Nothing So Hidden, the story of Apollo 16. 50 years ago today, the trio of astronauts were falling toward Earth on their homeward trip from the moon. On last week's program, we heard, in the astronauts' own words, their account of the journey to the moon, of their delayed descent to the Descartes region, and the beginning of their first moonwalk. This evening we pick up the story as their extravehicular activity enters a new phase, the setting up and use of the lunar roving vehicle. Now this account is as told to the Space Show in the studios of Southern FM by Charlie Duke in 2014, and a lecture recording we made in Canberra in 1994 of John Young. Now, this is supplemented by the in-flight press conference the trio gave whilst on their return flight from the moon.
I'll be by to get you in my old moon buggy. We will find a crater where we start getting hooky. And up there by the light of the good old earth, we'll love it up like everything for all that we're worth.
To extend the range the astronauts could go from their lunar module to collect geological samples, Apollo's 15, 16 and 17 used a dune buggy type car known as the Lunar Roving Vehicle, or LRV. Now, Young was asked about how it was carried to the moon and how it was deployed.
Out of all the footage that I've seen of the moon landing and I'm telling you that, I've never seen anything about the lunar buggy coming off the vehicle off the spacecraft, and I don't know whether it came off the whole thing where you put it together or
Well, Charlie Duke and I worked on that. We originally thought we were going to have the lunar module first, but the Apollo 15 guys got it when they cut one of the missions out. And it was all automatic at first, and it was on the side of the lunar rover, and you pull this wire, and that thing fell off and lay in front of you in a big heap. And nothing happened because the automatic system didn't work. So we had to make it semi-manual, where you pull a few ropes, and this part comes down, and then you attach this thing. It unfolds like a big Jeep. It's sort of like a card table that unfolds. Only it's got, instead of legs coming out, it's got wheels coming out. You slap them into place and put it all together. And I'm sorry that there's no television that ever been recorded, because the thing is, you've got to get the lunar rover all put together and then put the television on it for the thing to work. And that's why. But it is kind of like watching a card table unfold to see that thing. And sometimes it doesn't unfold too good.
John Young also described the lunar roving vehicle.
We had a lunar rover on the moon. It's a phenomenal vehicle. It's battery powered, two different sets of batteries. Each wheel was individually powered so that you could lose three out of four wheels being powered and still keep right on driving. The vehicle was very reliable. The tires were made out of piano wire. They couldn't even leak. Now, the handle in that vehicle has forward, backwards, stop, left, right, set the brake, set the parking brake, all in the same handle. And today, that handle is being used in the United States as what we call a space spinoff. It will allow very disabled people to drive safely on the freeways. I helped the Marshall Space Flight guys build that handle, and I'm very proud of that contribution. The good old lunar rover was very exciting to drive because it would do, we set the world speed record on the moon, believe it or not. believe it or not, it was 10 kilometers an hour. That's about as fast as we dared drive in that sliding, bouncing rover. And when you drove more than 5 or 6 kilometers an hour and cut the wheels too hard, it'd slide out or go backwards just like driving on ice. And what saved me and Charlie was that we knew nobody was coming down that road from the other direction.
Well, Melbourne hosts a Grand Prix motor race in Albert Park. Well, there's only been one Grand Prix on the moon. John Young was the only driver, and Charlie Duke was the official race commentator.
Back on, Mark. That max acceleration?
Oh.
Man, you are really bouncing.
Is he on the ground at all?
That's 10 kilometers.
Huh?
He's got about two wheels on the ground. It's a big rooster tail out of all four wheels. And as he turns, he skids. The back end breaks loose just like on snow. Come on back, John. Hey, the deck is running. Then I'll tell you, Andy's never seen a driver like this. Okay, when he hits the craters and starts bouncing, it's when he gets his rooster tail. He makes sharp turns. Hey, that was a good stop. Those wheels just locked. Mark off.
The actual first circuit was somewhat longer than the 36 seconds I've played here because I've edited out periods of static. As I've already noted, the Apollo 16 crew were not very talkative.
Second was okay.
We often see pictures of John Young test driving the rover on the moon, and I've always thought that was a bit of a silly thing to do before you'd done the traverses, the three traverses you did. Because,
well,
if you'd wrecked the thing then, you would
have been... Well, it turned out it was we call that the Grand Prix, and that was part of an actual test of the lunar module, the lunar rover, that we had scheduled. It wasn't just an off-the-cuff, you know, hey, let's do this, John. Now, it was all written into the flight plan, exactly what he would do, and it was actually after the first EVA. I mean, not after the first EVA, but we'd already done a geology out to Plum Crater, and we're coming back, and it was the end of our first EVA when we had this schedule. And so I got off, and I got the camera, the movie camera, and I said, okay, John, let's do the Grand Prix. And so he starts driving off, and I remember he drove towards the lunar module, and I said, okay, give me a sharp turn left, and which was part of the flight plan. And he said, I don't want to do a sharp turn. I said, come on, John, give me one. Okay, here's a sharpie, he said. And he did a 180 degrees, and the thing's bouncing like crazy. He's probably going doesn't sound like it's fast, but on the moon it was fast, like 6-7 kilometers an hour, and it was bouncing, and you can see that in the movie that I took. So it was scheduled, and I don't think we ever had an opportunity to wreck it, but you know, something could have happened to the steering and something like that, and then we'd have been down to one system, and that would have taken away our some of our mobility, if you will, on the subsequent EVAs.
And this reply prompted me to ask about extravehicular activity contingencies, because you had contingencies to walk if the rover didn't work.
Yeah, an EVA, walking EVA, that was on the maps if the car broke down or didn't work as we started out. And we also had a one-man EVA plan. If somebody's suit failed the check, he would stay in the lunar module, and only one person would go out. And we had that all worked out, but fortunately nobody ever had to do it. There were a lot of planning went into all these contingencies and, you know, what if this, what if that.
And Young did a second Grand Prix lap.
Okay, you could have gone the other way. Go ahead. There's the big craters there, though, aren't they?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. One of those holes.
They want 4 minutes worth, John. Well, it's 1:05. Then you can do it twice more.
Surely.
Okay, turn sharp.
I have no desire to turn sharp. Okay, here's a Sharpie.
Hey, that's great. Man, those things, when those wheels really dig in, John, when you turn, it's when you get the rooster tail. The suspension system on that thing is fantastic.
Yeah. That sounds good. We sound like we've probably got enough of the Grand Prix. We're willing to let you go on from here. Call that a Grand Prix.
Okay. Man, that was all four wheels off the ground there. Okay, max stop.
Lunar dust is made of fine particles of sharp-edged rock. It clung to everything.
This brush here in the foreground was used to wipe each other off. The lunar dust is very, very sharp-edged because it all comes from impacts. It's not rounded like sand at all. So when you brush it on your suit and you brush it off with a brush, it just digs in further. And takes more than one washing to get it out of there.
Another incident happened when John Young tripped over a data cable laying across the lunar surface and inadvertently tore it out of the heat flow electronics package. Could it be repaired?
Question 5. The heat flow experiment you broke was successfully fixed in simulation, although it was complicated and took a great deal of time. Do you think you should have tried to fix it or do what you did?
I don't think we're qualified to make that decision. It was made by people on the ground are far more qualified to do that sort of thing than we are. If we had been told to do that, we would certainly have done it.
Would you like to have been informed of the successful simulation and the trade-off factors involved?
I still don't think that that's our decision-making process up there on the surface.
And so the astronauts finished their first moonwalk. Now, this had begun at 2:54 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, when the 26-meter dish at Madrid was tracking, and it lasted 7 hours. The rover had been driven 4.2 kilometers in a time of 2 hours and 11 minutes. Well, back inside the lunar module, the crew had their meal and they went to sleep, and they slept from 3 p.m. until 11 p.m. And before retiring, Young was confiding in Duke a gastric problem he was having. Unfortunately, his microphone was on and his confidential confession was broadcast to the world. Well, of course, the press was onto this in a flash.
Apollo 16, the questions in this press conference have been prepared by newsmen covering the flight here at the manned spacecraft center. I'm going to read them to you exactly as worded by the newsman and in a priority specified by them. Question number 1 for John Young. A couple of times you were on hot mic and didn't know it. But how could a nice Florida boy like you say what you did about citrus fruit?
That's a very good question. Wait till you drink it day and night for 2 weeks and let me know what you think. And for lunch, too. I have an orange grove down in Florida, too, so I do like citrus, but citrus drinks are something else.
Rod Reimers explains what the comment was about.
Stories about human spaceflight are usually full of heroism, math, and the triumph of human ingenuity over incredible odds. The story of how an astronaut got the farts on Apollo 16 is no exception. It all started on the Apollo 15 mission, which landed on the moon in 1971. The mission was successful, but while they were in space, the astronauts experienced some arrhythmia, or irregular beating of the heart. Arrhythmia can signal all kinds of serious cardiovascular problems, like heart attack and stroke. So even though the astronauts made it back just fine, NASA very much wanted to make sure that astronauts on future missions avoided arrhythmia while they were in space, where humans have yet to establish any solid healthcare infrastructure. So NASA physicians did some blood work on the Apollo 15 crew when they returned to Earth, and found that they had too little potassium in their systems, a condition called hypokalemia. Potassium is super important for your heart because it's a major part of nerve cell function. And your nervous system is what controls your heartbeat. Specifically, potassium is used in the sodium-potassium pump, which is found in all kinds of cells, including those in every part of the nervous system. An enzyme separates out the sodium and potassium on either side of a nerve cell's membrane, building up voltage across the cell surface. For carefully timed bursts of cellular activity, you usually want the cell's membrane to reach a particular voltage before firing, called the action potential. Once you hit that voltage, the cell fires. Otherwise, it just waits for the voltage to build up again. A network of nerve cells throughout the heart rely on the sodium-potassium pump, among other cell signaling pathways, to time your heartbeat. If components of that system fall out of whack, like if you aren't getting enough potassium, your heartbeat can get off kilter. So be sure to eat your bananas, friends. But back to our astronauts. To keep the Apollo 16 astronauts safe from the arrhythmia experienced by the Apollo 15 crew, NASA prescribed a ton of potassium. Not enough to mess up the sodium-potassium pump in the other direction, but still a whole bunch. Potassium is typically very bitter, so it needs to be dissolved into something with a lot of flavor. NASA decided to use lots of citrus drinks. The crew had various citrus-flavored rehydratable drinks that they had to drink every day, multiple times a day. As you can probably imagine, the astronauts got really tired of this. And the diet had some physical downsides, which we know because NASA records all its communication with astronauts and makes the transcripts publicly available. At one point, the mission commander, John Young, was unaware that he had a hot mic. And, well, I'll just let you listen to what he said to fellow astronaut Charles Duke.
I got the farts again. I got them again, Charlie. I don't know what gives them to me. I think it's acid stomach. I really do. I mean, I haven't eaten this much citrus fruit in 20 years. And I'll tell you one thing. In another 12 days, I ain't never eaten any more.
So, of course, the press reported this. And because farts are always funny, everyone had a good laugh about it. That is, everyone except for Florida Citrus Mutual, the organization representing Florida's citrus industry. They issued some official statements saying that the astronauts were using artificial citrus drinks and not wholesome Floridian OJ, part of this complete balanced breakfast. So citrus is not to blame, and they would like you to please continue to buy their products. And that was true. The flatulence wasn't caused by fruit. It was the potassium. See, potassium is used in another enzyme pump in the digestive system. It's the hydrogen potassium pump. Your stomach acid is kept nice and acidic by an enzyme that pumps potassium in and hydronium ions out. The hydronium quickly dissociates to regular water and free hydrogen ions. Having free hydrogen ions in a solution is what makes it acidic. In fact, pH stands for power of hydrogen. So all the extra potassium the astronauts were taking in caused the hydrogen potassium pump to overwork, which gave them the farts. But their heartbeats were good and steady, so at least they solved that problem. There has actually been a great deal of research into space farts by NASA, because they pose a safety hazard. Methane is a flammable gas, so having a container of people emitting flammable gas on top of a rocket could conceivably pose some problems. But the amount of methane the Apollo 16 astronauts produced didn't cause a fire, and the astronauts didn't experience any arrhythmia. So unfortunately for the Apollo 17 crew, NASA physicians required the potassium diet for them.
Question 14. Did the potassium in your diet affect the taste of the food, and did it cause any other problems?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure we're qualified to say. We'll have to get back and talk to everybody. I don't think it. I didn't notice it being in there as far as taste was concerned, and I don't think anybody else did.
Yeah, this is one of those things where you have to wait and take a look at our post-flight medicals and see what they come up with as our body potassium level, because that's really the part that they're trying to work on, and I'm afraid the guys on the ground have a lot more data than we have on our physical condition, other than the fact that we know we feel good.
Yeah, I think we've been very fortunate to do as much of the mission as we have, considering how much we got slowed down there, and I don't know whether potassium anything to do with it or not, but if it did, I'm sure grateful that we were taking it.
You're listening to part two of Nothing So Hidden, the story of Apollo 16.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7, this is 88.3 Southern FM,
where you are listening to The Space Show.
Play the jukebox on. Hope they've got a jukebox on the moon. 'Cause if they've got a jukebox on the moon, I'll be going there real soon to play the jukebox.
Ever since the first American manned spaceflight in 1961, it had been the rule that only other astronauts could talk to the astronauts in space. At one point, whilst Apollo 16 was on the moon, the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station in the Australian Capital Territory was relaying the communications between the moon and Mission Control in Houston. When the link between Houston and Canberra was lost, this presented John Saxon with a problem. He could hear the astronauts trying to call Houston, but they could not hear Houston. John Saxon was the Honeysuckle Operations Supervisor. Now, sitting inside Orion and having breakfast before their second moonwalk, John Young and Charlie Duke were discussing with astronaut Tony England in Houston the upcoming moonwalk. Then the link breaks due to a fault in the United States. In order to inform the crew what is happening, Saxon pushes his press to talk switch to send his voice to the transmitter. And so history was made as John became the only Australian to speak to someone on the moon. The audio from Orion is of very poor quality due to the problems they were having with Orion's steerable high-gain antenna. Now, I've edited out long periods of static in what was originally an 11-minute exchange. In this 2-minute, 45-second edit, listen carefully and you'll hear John Young telling John Saxon to quaff a swan beer for them. And when Saxon doesn't understand, Charlie Duke repeats the request. Then he goes on to say they don't care about Houston and that the Honeysuckle guys are nice to talk to. Saxon invites the astronauts to Australia and promises to keep the beer cool. So listen close.
Orion, this is Honeysuckle. We have a comm outage with Houston at this time. Stand by one, please.
Okay, Honeysuckle, nice to talk to you. How
are
y'all doing down there?
We're doing great. Nice to talk to you.
Right, sounds good.
Roger that. We'll be with you shortly. We're just getting some lines.
Have a swan for us.
Say again, Orion, you're
pretty poor quality on this backup.
That Qantas 1-4.
I still can't copy you, Ryan. Sorry about this. The quality is very poor at the moment.
Okay, your lap clear.
Roger that. I read you a bit better now.
Sunny Suckle, what John was saying was Atlas 1-4.
Roger. Houston Contact, Honeysuckle Net 1, how do you read? Houston Contact, Honeysuckle Net 1, how do you read? Hi, Ron, this is Honeysuckle. We're still having a little trouble with the incoming from Houston. We should get it restored very shortly for you. Sorry about the delay.
Roger, thank you.
Okay, we're reading you this time for a change.
Okay, you guys are nice to talk to. We don't care about you.
Well, thanks very much. Certainly appreciate it. It's a pleasure working on this mission.
Roger. We'd sure like to come down there and see you folks after Silver, too.
Well, you've got a permanent invite anytime you like.
That's very kind.
We'll keep the beer cool for you.
You just got a couple fellas going to show up on your lawn here. That's the best idea I've heard all day.
I think it's a pretty good one down here, too.
That is. In my terminology, friendly 48 packs right now, the way I feel. Really love one.
Roger that. We're still having difficulty with the Iran. Hopefully, very shortly, we'll get the net up for you.
Okay. Take your time. Don't worry about it. We're eating.
Don't worry, Iran. We're worrying.
Voice net 1. Honeysuckle contact. Got a voice net 1. Voice check.
This is Honeysuckle. Loud and clear. How me?
Roger. Same. Step up in Houston, please.
Honeysuckle contact, Houston contact, net 1 for a comp check.
Loud and clear, Houston contact, how me?
Loud and clear also.
Yes, excuse me down here, I'm having AAA, the comm is really bad.
Well, Honeysuckle was reading us pretty good.
This exchange was picked up by the American press, who highlighted the reference to Swan Lager. The brewery got hold of the story and thought it was a marvellous publicity. They sent each of the astronauts a crate of beer. You know, they talk about the astronauts being heroes, and that I won't deny. But I reckon the guys at the tracking stations who sat through days of static trying to help the astronauts are just as big heroes. Oh, and one more thing, John Young and John Saxon did share a Swan Lager in Canberra. Well, it took the astronauts 2 hours to prepare for their second moonwalk, and they finally egressed at 3 a.m.
Hey, mysterious and unknown decoy, Allen Plains, Apollo 16 is going to change your image. You're glad they got old Bro Rabbit here back in the bright patch where he belongs.
And that last comment was a reference to Young as Brer Rabbit in the Joel Harris story Back Exploring in Space, where he felt he belonged. The second moonwalk lasted almost 7.5 hours, beginning at 2:45 a.m. and finishing at 10:08 a.m. The astronauts drove 11.1 kilometres. Again, tracking was done by Madrid as the moon set at Honeysuckle Creek just 30 minutes before the EVA began. Likewise, the third moonwalk would occur as most Australians slept. Starting at 1:26 a.m, it lasted 5 hours and 40 minutes until 7:06 a.m, by which time many Aussies were up and on their way to work. This time, Duke and Young had driven 11.5 kilometres. Over the three moonwalks, the rover had driven 26.8 kilometres and the two astronauts had collected 95.8 kilograms of lunar samples. Now, having stored these samples aboard the lunar module's ascent stage, it was time to leave the moon.
After all the mission rules, when it came down to the wire, did you land with helmets on or helmets off?
Everybody landed with helmets on. We were completely gloved. We had gloves and helmets on the ship system, environmental control system. And the reason was, if you touched down and the window popped out, you wanted to be able to survive. So anytime, anytime like when you undocked, you had helmets on and you were fully suited. Anytime it was something where you could lose pressurization due to an impact or a hard landing, then or the undocking command module and lunar module, you were completely suited with gloves and helmet so that you would survive.
In our Southern FM studio, responding to a question posed by Peter Owood of the Space Association of Australia. Well, liftoff was at 11:29 a.m. on that Monday morning, some 175 hours and 35 minutes after they had lifted off from Cape Kennedy. Now, Charlie Duke was very, very excited to leave the moon.
What a ride.
Years later, in Canberra, John Young gave this description.
We didn't stay on the moon forever. We parked that good old rover 100 meters behind the lunar module. The lower part of the lunar module stays, the descent stage and the ascent stage goes, that is if the engines light off. And we knew that there are about 200 ways that the ascent stage engines could fail to light off. We always thought of that as 200 ways to become the first permanently inhabited lunar base. Fortunately, our engines did light off. And that's what it looked like right after they did. You're looking down on that lunar surface. It's about 3.9 billion years old, very old surface. In the foreground up there is a descent stage. Back there is a rover. Right behind the descent stage is about a 30-meter crater. You can tell that because the footprints of the footpaths of the descent stage are about 10 meters across. So we just missed that. We just missed that 30-meter crater. People often ask, why did you miss that 30-meter crater? President Kennedy said in 1961, he said, in this decade, we're going to send a man to the moon and return him safely to Earth. The part about returning him safely to Earth kept us from hitting in that crater.
As I said in the first program, John Young was a man of few words, but he had a sense of humour. So were the astronauts worried that the engine of the lunar ascent stage might fail?
It takes 5 minutes and 30 seconds for the lunar module to get from the engine ignition into orbit. And Charlie Duke and I are proof positive that people can hold their breath for 5 minutes and 30 seconds.
Which is quite appropriate since Young's crewmate was Charlie Duke. That same Charlie Duke that was the capsule communicator during the Apollo 11 landing.
Altitude, velocity, light, in air, down, 220 feet, 15 forward, 11 forward, coming down nicely, 200 feet, 4.5 down, 5.5 down, within 60 feet, 6.5 down, 5.5 down, 9 forward, 120 feet, 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward, 5%, 185, 875 feet, that is looking good, down a half, forward, 60 seconds, lights on, down 2.5, forward, that's 30 feet, down 2.5, picking up some dust, 30 feet, 2.5 down, fake shadow, four forward, drift into the right a little, down a half,
30 seconds,
forward, just okay. Contact light, okay, engine stop, Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
The Orion's ascent went well, and at 1:35 on that Monday afternoon, docked with the command module Casper, which was being piloted by Ken Mattingly. To avoid crew work overload, it was decided to delay the transfer of moon rocks to the command module and the jettison of the lunar module until after the crew had slept.
Question 11. To what extent did fatigue affect your performance? For example, do you feel that you would have been capable of a full 7-hour EVA-3 liftoff and limb jettison all in the same day?
I think that had been pushing it a little.
Question 12 for each of you.
We could probably have done it, but I think I'd really been pushing it.
By the time many Australians were attending the Anzac Day dawn service, the astronauts had completed the transfer of moon rocks and photographic film from the lunar module to the command module. At 6:54 a.m., the lunar module was jettisoned. The command module continued to orbit the moon until 12:15 p.m. when its main propulsion engine was fired for 162 seconds whilst the craft was over the lunar far side. Due to the command module's earlier control system problems, Houston ordered the astronauts home a day early. In all, CASPER had completed 64 orbits of the moon. Unfortunately, the astronauts had set some switches in Orion incorrectly, so the planned deorbit as a seismic crash onto the lunar surface could not happen.
Question 10. Could you explain the circumstances surrounding the failure of the lunar module ascent stage to deorbit?
I think that has to be worked out when we looked at all the data on the ground and discuss it with the flight controllers. At the present time, I have no idea. No, I don't either.
On the return journey, it was Ken Mattingly's turn to get some attention. On Wednesday, April 26th, Ken left the command module and floated to the service module. There, he opened and jettisoned some panels and retrieved a large film canister holding mapping pictures of the moon as seen from lunar orbit. He was 381,000 kilometres from Earth and only 68,000 kilometres from the moon. The spacewalk began at 6 a.m. and lasted 1 hour and 24 minutes. The space show's Peter Owood had heard a strange thing had happened during this deep spacewalk and wanted Duke to confirm or refute this yarn. Right here, in our Southern FM studio, this is what Charlie Duke had to say about it.
People may be familiar with the From the Earth to the Moon series that ran a few years ago. And one of the scenes out of that was one of the episodes was about Apollo 16 and Ken Mattingly losing his wedding ring in the spacecraft and it actually floating out of the hatch during his EVA. And I believe you... It floated past you and you grabbed it, is that correct?
Well, I saw it floating out the hatch, and we'd been looking for this thing for 7 days or so. And I was down in the lower equipment bay, and when I got, I was wedged in, and by the time I broke loose and floated after it, it had already gone out the hatch, so I reached for it but missed it. So it slowly drifted out. The relative velocity between the spacecraft and the ring was just almost nothing. So it took about 3 minutes to float out about 3 meters and hit him on the back of the head. Amazingly, it took a 180-degree bounce and came back towards the hatch. It took three or four minutes to come back, inside. And it floated right in front of me in the LEB, and I grabbed it.
Oh, what a great
story. It was an amazing story.
That just sounded so much like Hollywood, but it was true.
As they neared Earth, the crew gave a televised press conference. Now, we've already heard parts of this, but here are some more questions. From his vantage point in CASPER, passing high above Descartes, which is where the Apollo 16 Orion landed, could Mattingly see the lunar module Orion?
Question 7 for Ken. Your observations of the landing site. Did you see the lunar module or the rover, and did you see any differences between Cayley and Descartes?
Okay, that's two distinct questions. Personally, did I see it? We never pointed the sextant at the landing site according to the flight plan because of the alterations we had. And there were two occasions. One's when I thought I caught a glint of light, which I could not recognize as the limb, but which came from the location and where I think the limb probably was sitting. And it's very close to the position on my map that you folks read up to me.
And once as the rover was starting up on Stone Mountain, I just happened to be looking as they went by, and I think you were on the shift tank and told me that they were hitting Stone Mountain. I looked over there, and about that time I got another little flash of light, which is about all with the 10 power optics we have that I think you could expect to see. In no time could you see something you could identify.
This is Nothing So Hidden, the story of Apollo 16, which continues in a moment.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
There's an American flag on the moon. We never looked at such a pretty moon.
It's just the beginning, you know we've won the race. Oh, glory will soon be all over the place.
The lunar far side, which can never be seen by us here on Earth, holds a particular fascination for most people.
Question number 8, again for Ken. What were your impressions of the backside of the moon, and were there any surprises?
Now, the impressions of the backside is something I tried to collect from the time we got there until the time we left, and I'm still mulling that over in my mind. Got a lot of transcripts we're going to have to read before I can psych it all out. But in general, the impression I have is that the material on the backside, when you look at it on as small a detail as I could look, looks to me like it's very much like the material we find on the front side surrounding most of the big craters. The thing that looks different is that the backside is devoid of these large basins. We don't have the large mares. There's very little mare. In fact, on the backside, the only mare we saw was really post-TEI, when we could look back and see a bigger area, but our ground track didn't pass over any mare in the daylight. So it took a while to psych that out, but I think that was a major difference, was the absence of these large basins. And on the backside, we see surprises. Well, we went up looking for, with a suspicion that we might find material similar to the Descartes formation located in several areas on the backside, and indeed, I think we did. I think we saw an awful lot. I think we saw a lot that looks exactly like the Cayley. I think the things that I saw that were probably the most surprising thing was on the side of a crater called Guyot, which is just to the north and a little west of King Crater, which is right about the eastern limb of the moon when you look at it from the Earth. We saw a big hole, I'll call it a crater, in the side of this, of the wall of this crater, and it appeared that there was material oozing out. And on our last couple of revs, we passed almost directly overhead, and it looked like it was filled with a pool of material, and then this material had run down the side. And that's a formation typical of things you see like in Hawaii, something I have not seen anywhere else on the moon, nor have I seen a picture of it.
And what of the Cayley-Descartes region of the moon where Apollo 16 landed?
The second part of that question was, did you see any differences between Cayley and Descartes?
Yes, I think there's a distinctly different morphology involved in these two units. Our pre-flight training is a little different in impression than what I think I saw. And again, we have, like I say, 10 power resolution. I think the real answer of what this material is going to lay in analyzing the data post-flight. We have some good film records, and I think when you put that together with the rocks we picked up, we'll have a pretty powerful story that will explain a lot of the things we don't know now. But I think that there are sections of material we call Descartes, particularly the material that makes up Stone and Smoky, and that stuff runs all the way south down to the old Descartes crater for which the region's named. And that does look texturally entirely different from the Cayley formation.
Trans-Earth injection is when the command and service module's engines is ignited to propel the craft out of lunar orbit and onto a trajectory towards Earth. One of John Young's comments puzzled the reporters back in Houston.
Question 15 for John. What did you mean when you said morale went up a couple of 100% after the successful TEI? Was it low?
Yes. No, not particularly. It's just, it would sure be low if you didn't get off the TEI burn, I can tell you that.
Again, John Young, rather brevity of comment there. Well, there was one general question that the press wanted to know about.
Question 12 for each of you. What do you hope to tell your grandchildren as your most memorable moment of your trip to the moon?
Well, I'll start with that one, Hank. I have two impressions. The first is the dazzling beauty of the cart, the surface. It was just one of the most awe-inspiring sights I've ever seen. And secondly, on the EVA, when you look away from the Earth or the moon, it's just the utter blackness of space. It really is black out there.
Time number 53, he said that.
Well, I guess I'm next, and I thought it, I knew someone would ask that question, and I've been asking that question, too. And I don't think I can put an impression. There's so many that we've crammed in the last 12 days. And it seems like each one comes on top of the other one, and the immediate response that you come up with is, that's the most fantastic thing I've ever seen. And in a lot of respects, it really is. There have been so many events and so many sights. But in my case, I'm going to have to sit and think about this one for a long time before I could ever pick out one. And I'm not sure I'll ever be able to say that there was a unique thing or a most memorable event. The whole thing has been just one series of very impressive and, I hate to use the word, but I don't know anything else except to say it's fantastic.
I think Ken's got the answer. I think we've seen as much in 10 days as most people see in 10 lifetimes. And we certainly have enjoyed it.
And what would they tell the crew of Apollo 17, which would be the final Apollo lunar landing in December of 1972?
Question 16. For each of you, based on your experience, do you have any recommendations right now for the crew of Apollo 17?
Yeah, I recommend they enjoy it as much as we did. I'm sure they will. But I tell you, we really have had a lot of sights to see. I'll admit that in a lot of cases we worked hard, and I suppose the people on the ground were able to tell that, but we got all the support in the world from the MCC Houston. I could tell from every decision that came up from the ground that there'd been a lot of work put into it, and all around the country that there were a lot of wheels turning, and people working late hours and solving these problems. And I'm just really happy that Ken, Charlie, and myself got to do this. And I think it's a wonderful experience.
That was the last question, John. We thank you very much, and thanks for the kind comment.
In 1971, it had been proposed that a joint space mission be conducted with the Soviet Union. An Apollo spaceship would link up with a Salyut space station. The mission was dubbed the International Rendezvous and Docking Mission, and engineers were busy designing the docking apparatus.
Question 13. From an astronaut's point of view, would you discuss the possible operational difficulties, besides language, to be overcome in the proposed joint US-USSR manned spaceflight? And would you have any suggestions to make?
From an astronaut's point of view, I would not feel qualified to discuss it, other than to say that if language is a problem, I'll be glad to learn Russian. I think Charlie and Ken feel the same way.
Well, that proposal morphed into the Apollo-Soyuz test project, in which Apollo 18 docked with Soyuz 19 in 1975 in Earth orbit. Well, back to Apollo 16. On Friday, April the 28th, Apollo 16 entered the Earth's atmosphere and parachuted to a splashdown in the Pacific Ocean, some 2,400 kilometers south of Hawaii.
Another remarkable thing we did was come back to Earth very fast, 44,800 kilometers an hour. The temperature that you see there, that white hot glow, is above 3,000 degrees C. Inside the vehicle, it's 20 degrees C. That's really nice. Now, we knew that we had a very good guidance system. It would land you about it would land you in the Pacific Ocean, and we were aiming off Samoa, and we landed about a mile and a half from where we're aiming at, which is very good. We had other ways to do it. You could even use the G-meter and get back. If nothing else was working, you could fly back by the seat of your pants. Unfortunately, when those things weren't working, the places you could land at got larger and larger and larger. But we knew from practice, at least I knew from practice, that I was at least good enough to hit the Pacific Ocean. And you land in the ocean using parachutes. My old instructor in the airplanes, he says, never jump out of a good airplane and never use a parachute unless you have to. And there we were using them all the time. And it worked. They all three worked.
Yes, that was John Young speaking in Canberra. Well, let's have a little bit of music to take us out towards Purple Haze and Nick Black, who's in the next studio getting ready for his program. This is Moonwalk by Moon Taxi. And even in 2005, the Moonwalks were inspiring people. And the vocal is by Laura.
I made a mistake. I lost my sunshine while running.